We have nothing to fear for the future except as we forget the way the Lord has led us in the past and the teachings in our past history. This generation is going to learn not only by trial and error, but by other people's trial and error. Now, the study that I'm going to give this morning is naturally going to be very brief. It's going to be a thumbnail sketch. I'm going to put a lot of things in as few words as I can, because this is going to be somewhat the chronological history of self-supporting work. I'm not interested in spending a lot of time in just the facts, but I am interested in principles. There have been two histories of Madison written. I don't think either one of them dealt with the real problem. And the things that I'm going to say today are going to be pretty straight. But we must learn to look at things from God's viewpoint and not man's. Because the greatest and most terrible insanity is what? Following human wisdom instead of what? God's wisdom. And you'll find that every apostasy has come from following human wisdom instead of God's instruction. Much of what is written in education and in medical work will not be used in the last days of Earth's history. Now you say that's a strange statement. But remember that God started out with the prophet to tell people what to do to get ready for heaven. They didn't expect there was going to be any time lapse. Did James and Ellen White expect to go to heaven very soon? Did they expect the message to be finished rapidly? Did they expect to take the message to the world in a very short time? Yes. The children of Israel could have gotten from Egypt to Canaan in how long? Yes, less than 2 weeks. 8 days' journey. How long did it take them to get there?
40 years.
40 years. Did they ever get there?
Yes.
Not really.
Not really
got there. They didn't really get there. They could not enter in. Third chapter of Hebrews, they did not enter in because of unbelief. Something is left for us to do because we must not fail as they failed. They entered into the promised land, but did they ever enter into God's rest that He intended them to enter into? God gave Israel a lot of laws that says they couldn't live by. Have you read this in Deuteronomy? Laws that they couldn't, that were not really for their best good, for a holding operation. So go back and study this. I've just gone through it several times. Now I want to read a statement, and this will explain this statement that I made. I'm not downgrading the spirit of prophecy. I'm not downgrading inspiration. This is page 41 of Selected Messages, Book 1. Write the things I have given you to confirm the faith of my people in the position they have taken. Time and trial have not made void the instruction given, but through years of suffering and self-sacrifice have established the truth of the testimony given. The instruction that was given in the early days of the message is to be held as a safe instruction to follow in this its closing days. What instruction? The early instruction. Go back and read the early testimonies. Read early writings. Read the messages that came in the early days. The Lord was going to take them right into the promised land. It says, those who are indifferent to this light and instruction must not expect to escape the snares which we have plainly been told will cause the rejectors of light to stumble and fall and be snared and taken. If we study carefully the second chapter of Hebrews, we shall learn how important it is that we hold steadfastly to every principle of truth that has been given. Now, much of the instruction in education and medical work has been to keep us from going farther than we were. Now, hopefully you understand what I'm saying. It was instruction to keep us from going into full apostasy. And much of the destruction was a holding operation. But friends, when we finish the work, we're going to do it just like Jesus did. And there are a lot of things that we need to study, we need to understand, but we need to realize that the early instruction is that we're going to follow. Now, another thing that we have to understand, Ellen White says it's impossible for any human being to give a true biography without being inspired. Have you read that? No one can give a true biography of anyone without inspiration. You see, if you and I had written the history of David, we probably would have written entirely different, wouldn't we? Or of Solomon. But inspiration gives not only what happens, but the background and all about it, and gives the reasons for why things happen. Now, I'm dealing with biographies today, and I have two biographies here, one by William Sanborn. He wrote it for his doctoral thesis, The History of Madison. I have one written by Harry Chrisman and Ira Gish. I know all these men very well, and Bill Sanborn's dead. I worked with him for years. I knew Chrisman's and Gish both at Madison for many years. These are good men. They all got their education in the schools of the world. They didn't understand the underlying principles. People are still talking, we ought to have Madison back. Madison ought to be renewed, and says Madison still lives. Well, Madison does. The principles of Madison still live. They call the period from 30 to 50 the golden years. To me, it's the tragic years. It's not the golden years at all. The golden years of Madison were the first 15 years of their existence. This is when they did the work that we are to emulate, not what happened in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. In 1865, Dr. Sutherland was born while they were crossing the prairie from Wisconsin over to Iowa. According to this record, he was born when they were crossing the Mississippi River. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, he came in pioneer days. About 3 years later, both Dr. Paulson, David Paulson and Percy McGann were born. They were 2 or 3 years younger than Dr. Sutherland, E.A. Sutherland. Sutherland grew up on a farm. He learned to work, and he had a thirst for education. And in 1888, he went to Battle Creek to get his education. He wanted to enter college, but he didn't enter college that year. He had a sister there, and he went to Bell's school, Goodloe Bell, who was the greatest English teacher this denomination ever had, and was a firm advocate of practical education. He did not receive his education in schools of men. I don't know that he ever had a degree, but he was a master teacher, wrote a book on English that was used for years. Sutherland sat at his feet, then he entered Battle Creek College. He graduated from Battle Creek College in 1890. That year he was married, and they taught in Battle Creek for a couple years. They got a call to Union College. There's a little confusion as to what happened there. I don't think he took the call. Anyway, he taught about 3 years at Battle Creek College. This was the days of great expansion in our educational work. The message on education came in 1872. And by the way, to just corroborate what I'm saying here, I wish all of you would make a special study of the early instructions on education. If you want to get what the real kernel of education, read the first article that came out on education. It's on page 131, beginning volume 3 of the Testimonies. It's the first chapter in Fundamentals of Christian Education. It's about three places. It's also in the later part of Counsels to Teachers under Practical Education, I believe it's called. But anyway, the whole article is on volume 3, starting page 131. Read it through carefully. Because remember, the instruction that came when? In the early days is going to be safe instruction in his closing days. You'll find that what she says there, and then if you want to read what the problem is and why we are still in this world, read the chapter in volume 6 on educational reform. This was only a few years later. And let me say this, folks. Seventh-day Adventism and Seventh-day Adventist schools never got on God's program in education from the very start. It was a new program. They didn't know how to do it. They put men in who were fresh from the university, who knew nothing about reform education, and they had real struggles. There were some men who wanted to follow the writings of Ellen White, which carried out the instruction that says that the most important part of education is what? Practical, useful work. Does it say that over and over again? If you must neglect one, neglect what? The books. I know from personal experience, I worked my way through all the schooling I ever had. And the work that I learned to do in getting my education, I've used all my life. The education I never used very much except helping other people to be impractical in many ways. Now that may sound strange, see, but the education that I got that was real important was working my way through school. That I've never forgotten. I've used it all my life. It's taught me more spiritual lessons. Do you agree with this? There's an old classmate of mine back in the Hinsdale days. Now, in 1883, Healdsburg was established. In 1884, South Lancaster was established in the Atlantic Union College. In 1891, Union College was established. See, we started schools in the early days. And in 1892, Walla Walla College was established. And Edward Sutherland and his wife, Sally, went there, and Prescott was president of Battle Creek College. He was also president of Walla Walla. My mother was teaching in Milton Academy before Walla Walla College was established. Milton Academy was just south. That's where my father and mother met. Fascinating story. My mother and father were married, and he went out in evangelism. My oldest brother was born in Milton, Oregon in 1890. So they were involved in this whole thing. I've heard many stories of the early days. Dr. Sutherland has told me many stories. I worked many years with Dr. Sutherland. But I've just got to make this brief. Dr. Sutherland went to Walla Walla in 1892, and then the messages were bombarding the United States from Avondale, Australia. And the strongest and the most potent messages that ever came from the pen of Ellen White on education came in the 90s. When they were establishing Avondale. The group at Walla Walla really wanted reform education. And Ed Sutherland and Percy McGann were the two foremost people in promoting reforms in Adventist education. It was in Walla Walla College that meat was taken out of the college and vegetarian diet was instituted. That wasn't instituted at Battle Creek. Now, one of the red books I read said they started at Battle Creek. They may have started a little bit, but I've heard Dr. Sutherland tell some fascinating stories about the struggles they went through to get rid of meat at Walla Walla College. And he taught there for 4 years. Battle Creek was going through a real struggle. They were not following the instruction that came from Ellen White, and in 1894, Sutherland was called from Walla Walla College to come back and take charge of Battle Creek. And he came there, and Percy McGann had been in school there and had just finished his school, and Percy McGann with Sutherland and M. Bessie DeGraw started a reform program at Battle Creek. I'm not. I said 1894. I'm sorry. It was 97 that he came back. They were in battle, he was in Walla Walla until 96. That was the days when Walla Walla was being established. Read the story. It's fascinating. There's quite a bit of this book on Madison, God's Beautiful Farm. There's a lot of good historical facts here. There's some things that I think are tragic that are not said, but that's all right. The history of this work will never be understood until we get to heaven. But there's some things we need to understand today, because if we do not learn from history, history condemns us. Is that right? We must learn from the things that happened. All right, in 1897, Sutherland came back, and Sutherland, McGann, and M. Bessie DeGraw were the leaders in the Battle Creek College from 1897 to 1901. And they started instituting reforms. They started instituting short courses. They started to try to put in this speedy preparation that the Lord had told us we should have, not years of academic work and when we studied the ancient languages, you know, and all of the things that were necessary back in those days. They endeavored to start a reform education. There was a lot of opposition to it. When Sutherland came back to Battle Creek, Battle Creek had been captured by a group of people who wanted to go into scholasticism and education. And there was a struggle for control. He told me this himself. A man who was interested in that type of education had cornered the stock on Battle Creek College. It was a stock corporation, and you voted according to how much stock you had. He had cornered the majority of the stock. Dr. Sutherland told me that he called a board meeting every day for 67 days. Now, this is the kind of man he was. And they would vote. And the 67th day, the man forgot to vote some of his stock, and Sutherland and his group took over Battle Creek College. He told me that himself. There was a real struggle going on. There was a fight for control. And then, that was when they instituted this reform education. Ellen White came back from Australia and was at the 1901 General Conference. This is when the reorganization took place. This is when A.G. Daniels came in. And remember, this was right in the heart of the Alpha apostasy. If you read the book Omega, you can know what was happening. And I want to say again what I said to begin with. We have to see the importance of self-supporting work in the time in which it came in. It came in when the medical work, the medical missionary work, as God intended it should be given, had been captivated by the pantheism theology. And as a result of that, the evangelistic or the ministerial department had sort of backed off from health work and went into the doctrinal relationship. And there, as I said before, came the deadly wound, when medical work was separated from the ministerial work. And get your books, look up the index and read the instruction. The Lord never intended that the medical work and the educational work should ever be separated, because in the life of Jesus, this was the true ministry. The medical work, the medical missionary work, is the demonstration of the compassion of the gospel. And this was to be the entering wedge, and this is where it was separated. And so, in 1901, they were trying to carry on those reforms, and they realized that they could not do it. Well, it was very interesting. In those years when they were trying to do this, they had only a few acres at Battle Creek. They had put in tennis courts, they'd put in ball diamonds, and Ed Sutherland, and Percy McGann, and it says with J.G. Lampson. I knew J.G. Lampson, he was my teacher at Hinsdale. He was a big fella, and they said one of them drove the team, the other one held the plow, and Lampson sat on the front of the plow, and they plowed up the tennis court and the baseball diamond and put in gardens. And this caused a furor. The students didn't want that. And so I'm just giving you some of the background. But these were men. These were men of God. They were led of God. They did a tremendous work. These men were far-seeing men. And they were trying with the best of their ability to carry out the instruction the Lord had given. 1901 at the General Conference, Sullivan McGann says, how can we ever carry out God's plan of education with Battle Creek College in Battle Creek? Ellen White says, move it out! And in that General Conference, they voted to move Battle Creek College to the country. Sullivan McGann got on their bicycles, they took boats, they took trains, they took everything they could get to go out in the country and finally located a piece of land on the banks of the St. Joseph River in Berrien Springs. And they were ready to move, and shortly after that, they moved all of the belongings of the Battle Creek College on 16 flat cars and took them to Berrien Springs and unloaded them in an old barn. Part of the time there was an old jail that they worked in. These were primitive days. And you know what happened shortly after they'd moved? The Battle Creek people, and this was the headquarters of the denomination, were very unhappy about Battle Creek College moving, so they got together and voted not to move Battle Creek College. And Sutherland again says, we're sorry, brethren, it's already moved. And so they began at Berrien Springs. And then were two very difficult years, from 1902 through to 1904. They were endeavoring to institute reforms. The denomination as a whole didn't want reforms. Parents had been educated wrong. Students had been educated wrong. They didn't want that type of education. And the difficulty got so bad. Percy McGann's wife was a doctor, she was a very fine woman, and the criticism came in so bad, they were under such pressure to go the way of the world in education that she died a martyr. Ellen White wrote and said, you martyred this woman by your unkind criticism. And the denomination was not satisfied. Remember, we were right in the midst of the Alpha apostasy. We were in confusion. Pantheism was taking over the medical work. And the church leaders were backing off from the medical work because they associated medical work with pantheism. Do you understand? We could only understand that if we'd lived back there. And here, Sullivan McGann were in the middle of it. And they came to a meeting in the spring of 1904, and the pressure was on. And Sutherland McGann got together and said, there's only one answer to it. We're not giving them the kind of education they want. We'll resign. And so they resigned from Emmanuel Missionary College in 1904, and Ellen White wrote them a letter and says, brethren, you let the Lord down. You should have stayed on. But they didn't. They just felt they couldn't take it anymore. Dr. McGann's wife had died. They weren't doctors. They were both professors. And so they went south. They wanted to go back way in the hills of the south and start a little school, a real insignificant school. They wanted to start from the beginning. Well, they went down and they looked around, and Ellen White says, well, I want to meet you in Nashville. Edson White had his boat, the Morning Star, which was built down here in Allegan, and he was using it, going up and down the rivers, doing work for the colored people. Well, Ellen White met them at Nashville, and I've forgotten who was on that trip. I believe it was Haskell and maybe Butler. He was president of the union. I've forgotten the two sons of Ellen White, and Ed Sutherland got on this boat and started up. They were going towards Carthage. They were looking for a place. It broke down at Edgefield Junction. The boat broke down. And they pulled into Larkin Springs. I've been there many times. And they said, well, they thought they could repair the boat. And they went out, and Ellen White went up on top of the hill and looked over. And she says, I've seen this place before. And as she looked around, she says, yes, this is the place. This is the place the Lord showed me that you should start your school. Well, Sutherland says, no, this isn't the place. It can't be the place. It was an old broken down farm, an old worn out farm that had been farmed to death. And if any of you ever been in Madison, the limestone rocks were sticking out in all directions. it was not a ideal place to start a farm. There are lots of beautiful farms in the South, and this is one of the rugged ones. They had cattle, they had their pigs right close to the house, and everything was run down. It was in bad shape. And so Ellen White says, "This is the place." She says, yeah. He says, "No, we want to go out farther than this." She says, "Nashville is a center. You must start it here." Well, they met McGann in Nashville, and Ellen White says, "Well, I've got to go out and look over that farm again. It's 9 miles from Nashville." She got a carriage and went over and looked at it. Sutherland says, "I'm not going to look at it. I don't even want to see it." And so finally she got Sutherland and McGann to go out with her, and she talked to them, and it was very interesting. I was just their conversation. Now, I've heard McGann and Sutherland tell about this a good many times, but this is probably not the words that they spoke, but this is pretty close to it. And I thought that it would be very interesting to see what the report was. And this is Mrs. Wyatt hired a carriage and drove over the farm. Still very much impressed with its possibilities, she invited the conference brethren out, and several parties tramped over the place inspecting every part of the farm. The more they looked it over, and the more she declared that it was a beautiful place and the spot where the institution should be founded, the more Professor Sutherland began became downhearted. There was a large pile of rocks near where the Scott House is located today. Loads of rocks had been piled up there through the years. The boys, as they were often endearingly spoken of by some close to them, but older and wiser in years, had to make a decision. Here they stood by the rock pile, discouraged, for they were just as sure that this was not the place as Mrs. White was sure it was the right place. They stood at the crossroads, just like Saul did. Saul, it says, recognized that Samuel was a prophet. And when Saul rejected the instruction of Samuel, it says it became satanic sorcery. Do you remember I read that statement to you? Torn between their own personal feelings and the instruction of Mrs. White, they sat down on the pile of rocks to think the situation through. Finally, Professor Sutherland said to Professor McGann, "Percy, you know that we have claimed that we believe in the spirit of prophecy and have always believed in what Sister White said. We must either accept this place, or we might just as well give up being Seventh-day Adventists and refuse the prophecy." You see, they were facing the crisis. Either they would have to accept what God said, or listen, folks, the people today who have been Seventh-day Adventists through the years and reject the message of Seventh-day Adventists and the prophets of Seventh-day Adventists are no longer Seventh-day Adventists, whether they believe it or not. They have come to the parting of the ways. Well, they began that farm, and they bargained for it. They were to get it for $12,000. The wife of the man that owned it didn't sign the contract, and they went out to raise the money. They came with the money, and the man says, "I can't sell it. My wife won't sign the deed. We've got to have $1,000 more." And Sutherland and McGann almost jumped up and down for glee. They said, "At last we're out of it." And Ellen White says, "Listen, boys, you think we're going to let the devil cheat us out of this place for $1,000? Pay the $1,000 and get this farm." Well, they got it, and they started their work. Now, something very interesting. This was in June of 1904, and in March of 1904, David Paulson went before this. David Paulson had gone to Hinsdale, and a man by the name of Kimball, and if I remember right, Kimball is a man who made the Kimball organs. He was a wealthy man, lived in Hinsdale, said, "I'll buy this land for you. You ought to start a place in Hinsdale, and if you will start a sanitarium here, I'll buy the land and I'll let you pay for it on 20 yearly payments with no interest." And so he said, well, you can't beat that. And so he went out there. They moved into an old ramshackle house, and that was the starting of Hinsdale, the self-supporting institution of the North. Well, I just have to briefly say what happened during the interim years. They went, when they really got into it, then they, Ellen White got Nellie Droulard, known by everybody as Mother D. Her husband had died, and she was a very shrewd administrator, and they had accumulated a little money. They'd been missionaries over in Africa, and so Ellen White says, Nellie, if you'll go and join those boys down at Madison and help them get that started, God will prolong your days, and the last years of your days will be the most fruitful. She was at that time 60 years of age. So she did. She helped them raise the money. They got the farm. And when they went into it, they went into it wholeheartedly. And folks, these were the golden years of Madison. Dr. Sutherland, Sutherland McGann, they went in and they began to work. McGann was in charge of the farm. Sutherland was in charge of the simple education they had. I've heard him tell. He said, we had no textbooks. We didn't know what to study. But they started out with the first chapter of Genesis. They brought about 12 students from up north. Two of them were Mulford and Alden, and old Brother Brink, who was from the north, went down, and he was their dairy farmer, and this supported them for several years. Dr. Sutherland used to churn the butter, and Bessie DeGraw got in, and they made bread, and she got in their wagon and went, their cart, or whatever it was, I guess surrey of some kind, and went to Nashville and sold butter and bread. And that was how they got their first income. Well, they started out their educational program. And I've heard both Dr. Sutherland say, and the early ones that went to school, they went to school for 3 months. And Sutherland says, all right, I've taught you all I know. You go out and reproduce it. And after they'd been there 3 months, people went out and began to start little outposts out in the country. Their education was very simple. The teachers all worked together in the morning, and the afternoon they had their school. And then when they got into a more formal education, then they went on the one study plan for many years. This was the beginnings of the Madison educational program. Remember that from 1904 to 1915, 9 years, Ellen White worked very closely with them. You find many testimonies in the Spaulding McGann Sutherland collection. I have Series A and Series B, many of the testimonies especially Series B, are written regarding Madison and the work there. And she served on the board of Madison in the early days. It's the only board she ever served on in her life. Well, they began to go out into the South and start these outposts. Madison, they were told that they should start a sanitarium. And they didn't want to start a sanitarium, but a man in Nashville was sick, and he says, I want you to come out and have you help me. And they said, well, we're not ready. He said, I've got to have some help. And he came out, and he was a well-known man, and he was helped, and this was the beginning. They started their little sanitarium. It began to grow. Well, my folks moved south in 1909, and I can't tell you that story. It's very interesting. My father was an evangelist, a minister in California. His children, I'm the youngest of the family. My brothers and sisters were all considerably older than I. My oldest brother was 16 years older than he was 16 years old when I was born. And in 1908, my folks sent him to Madison, and he entered the Madison School in 1908, 4 years after it started. Then my folks came south, and my father asked for a leave of absence from the conference. McElhaney was president of the Pacific Union Conference, and he gave my father a leave of absence, and they paid his salary for a year. He came south, and he went all over the South as a revivalist in the Southern Union. The work was very backward in those days. Well, anyway, then my father went into self-supporting work, went out 30 miles from Madison, out in the hills of Tennessee, and bought a farm. And I was coming to the age then when I needed education, so my mother started a school. And the first years of my life, up to 1920, I was closely associated with Madison. My brothers and sisters all went to school there. I didn't go to school there. And I can tell you many interesting experiences. That the conventions in those days were thrilling experiences. These people were going out pioneering these little schools, and in 1920, 16 years after Madison had been established, there were 50 outposts in the southern field. People had gone out and started places from Madison, and the education in the South was very poor. Well, to go back a little bit, in 1895, there was a medical school started in Battle Creek by Dr. Kellogg. It was affiliated with work in Chicago. In fact, it was incorporated under the Illinois state laws, and they began about 1900 to graduate doctors from this medical school. It was called American Medical College. And this operated until 1910. And in 1910, the denomination had left. Battle Creek was becoming small as far as Adventist concerns were concerned. Dr. Kellogg had taken Battle Creek away from the denomination. They had joined the Baptist Church, and there was a great apostasy at Battle Creek, and so the college closed. And 1910, the instruction was coming from the prophet, start a medical school. And that's when the property at Loma Linda was established. You can read the history of that. It's very fascinating. Elder Burden went there and got the farm. The denomination didn't want to get involved in it, and that was the start of the medical school. The medical school at Loma Linda was intended to train people for medical missionary work. They were to train a few doctors with licenses to head up our institutions, and the great majority of their graduates were to be not licensed, not able to practice, but health educators. Well, this began in 1910. They were having a real struggle. The school was about to close, and the General Conference came down to Madison. Well, in the meantime, in 1911, Sutherland had decided the only way they could have a sanitarium at Madison was to take the medical course. So he decided to take medical course at Vanderbilt University that had a medical training, and McGann says, well, I want to take it too. So the two of them went, and they graduated the medical course. I'm not sure the dates. They're somewhere around 12 or 13. I guess they started a little before that. They graduated from Vanderbilt University Medical School and became doctors. And then their sanitarium work began to really develop. 1914, Loma Linda was just about to close. And the men from the General Conference, the chairman of the board of the Loma Linda Institution, came to Madison and said, we've got to have some help. Would you release Dr. McGann to come out here and head up Loma Linda? And so they didn't want to separate, but they did, so McGann went to Loma Linda. And then there was a transition period for about 6 years. They didn't exactly know which way Loma Linda should go. The instruction was that we should train doctors not according to the world standards, train them not to use drugs, train them to use simple methods, and there was no school that was giving that kind of medical training. Well, in 1920, I left the farm down in Tennessee and went to Hinsdale. I never went to Madison as a student until in the 30s. I don't know why the Lord led me to the Hinsdale Institution, but I went there. Well, my sister was a nurse. She'd been trained at Madison and then took some more training and went to Hinsdale to visit, and I asked her to take charge of the lifeboat mission work in Chicago. They were doing Chicago outreach, and so she accepted that. My other sister went to Hinsdale, decided she'd go there and take nursing. My brother, older brother, had taken nursing at Madison, and then he'd gone to Hinsdale and taken more work, and he had finished there, and so it was time for me to go away to school. My mother said, I've taught you all I can teach you. You need to go and get some more formal education. So I went to Hinsdale. It was the There were only two schools in the denomination at that time you could work your way through. One was Madison and one was Hinsdale. And because my sisters were there, I went to Hinsdale. I spent 8 years at Hinsdale. So I had no connection with Madison at all during the period from 1920. And then after I finished Hinsdale, I went out and worked. I was married. I went to Pensacola, Florida, and there I was converted at the age of 25. And then I went out into self-supporting evangelism. And then I was called back to one of the Madison units, and in Kiwi Valley, I started the academy there. And then, because I hadn't finished my college, why, they wanted me to go back and finish college. So in 1934, I went to Madison. And when I went to Madison, I was having a real Christian experience. The Lord had taught me a lot of things. And when I saw what was happening at Madison, my heart was broken. I realized that what people say was the golden years were the tragic years. Now, I'll tell you the story, very briefly, what happened to Madison. This story's never been told. I'm telling you some things that have never been told. My brother was there all during this time. He was either in Madison or was in a unit of Madison. My father and mother had a unit of Madison out in the country, 30 miles, and then when I went away to school, they went down to Florence, Alabama, and the Lord led them to a place there called El Reposo. They called it El Reposo. In the outskirts of Florence, Alabama, my father started there, and my brother later took over that. Well, anyway, here's the story. I'll tell it very briefly. When Dr. McGann went to Loma Linda, he knew that Loma Linda had to have some direction because it was floundering. You know, they didn't know which way to go. And folks, look, we as individuals and we as institutions often face the experience of Kadesh Barnea. When the Lord is going to say, are you going to go possess the land or aren't you? And I don't know what happened, only God knows. But as they were trying to find direction for the school, in the early 20s, Dr. McGann decided that, and the people there, the board, whoever it was, that Loma Linda should train medical doctors. They were to train medical missionary doctors, but they decided to train medical doctors. They got in with the AMA, joined the AMA, and went into the formal medical training. We had no school in the denomination at that time that was accredited, and Loma Linda was going for accreditation. And if they were accredited, they had to have students to come from schools that were accredited. My brother told me this. He said, Dr. McGann came to Madison and said, Ed, Loma Linda is going for accreditation. If Madison will get accreditation, we can bring all the medical students through Madison and we can cover the South with doctors. Sounds good, doesn't it? There was only one problem. What was it? What was it? Human reasoning. Human reasoning. Sounded beautiful. Madison was the first school in the denomination that went for accreditation. They first got their high school accreditation, and if you read the book, it sounds beautiful. And then when they got their high school accreditation, they said, well, we're going to have 14 grades to get into medical school, so they got their 14 grade accreditation. And you've read the stories. This was the late 20s and early 30s. Read Wilcox's article. Read Spaulding's article. Read the articles that were coming out from Howell, from McElhaney, from all these leaders, Branson in those days. And as soon as the educational people in the Adventist Church saw what Madison was doing, then began the scramble for accreditation. Every college in our denomination went for accreditation. Now, folks, there's nothing wrong with accreditation. The problem is, what do we do to get accreditation? You see, they have set up standards. Folks, we could have had our own accreditation program. You think God wouldn't have seen us through?
Oh, yeah.
Of course He would. Did you know that Christian scientists, practitioners have an exemption from medical practice laws in every state of the Union and in every country of the world? It specifically states in the Medical Practice Act that this does not apply to Christian Scientist practitioners. You think Seventh-day Adventists couldn't have had exemptions and carried on our program? And would we have been in advance of the other? Why, we would have been as far ahead as... We would have been the head and not the tail. And folks, we made the same mistake that Israel did. First, Israel wanted a king. Because they wanted to be like what? Like the nations around them. We wanted accreditation. And because it would give us access to so many people. And so it began. I went to Madison in 1934. And I was sick. As I saw what was happening, they had called in old doctors, PhDs, retired men. I sat in a history class with an old teacher who almost every class, after he started his class, went to sleep and slept for about a half hour during the class while we sat there and did nothing. Now, this doesn't sound very nice. But they were having, and then they began to pull in the leaders from these little self-supporting institutions because they were strong men. They were leaders. They called them in, began them sent to the university to get their doctor's degree. And then began the crumbling of the Madison structure. Instead of evangelizing, they began to pull in to strengthen Madison to meet accreditation. And when I went there in 1934, Madison was full blast for accreditation. And there's an interesting thing happened. Madison got 14 grade accreditation. First school in the denomination that got accreditation. And then Loma Linda says, all right, we're going for senior college requirements to get into medical school. So many doctors wanted to come. And I mean, so many people wanted to be doctors. So Madison relinquished their 14 grade accreditation and went for senior grade accreditation. And the simple story is that of all the schools in Adventism, only Madison never got its accreditation. Every other school got its accreditation, but Madison didn't. And I was in there in the interim period, and I saw what was happening. And I knew what Madison had been in the early days, and I was heartsick. I went there in the summer of 1936, and I was praying. And I don't know if I should tell this or not. Well, I guess I should. I was praying and I said, what is going to happen? What's going to happen to Madison? I was there with the man who was in charge of Pee-wee Valley. He and I were sleeping. I had built a motor home. We were sleeping in it. I just went there for summer school and I had a dream. And this was the most fantastic dream I ever had in my life. In this dream, the Lord appeared to me. And he said, now I've heard your prayers, and I've called you to reform this. And I woke up, and I was sweating, and I thought, I'm sure glad that's a dream. I was a young man, about early 30s, without very much experience. In fact, I was just 30. I just reached my 30th birthday. And it scared me to death. And I went back to sleep, and I said, I'm sure glad that's a dream. Well, you know what happened? I dreamed that dream again. And I woke up, and I was weeping. And I said, Lord, I don't know what this is. I don't know what it's all about. Well, that's all I knew. I told the man that was there, I said, I don't know what this is all about. He said, well, only the Lord knows. Well, I just put it back in the back of my mind. And in... I finished Madison. I was called to a school. I spent about 16 years, 14 to 16 years in the Madison system. I was in charge of two different institutions, and in those I tried to reform the school system. But Madison, when it went for accreditation, ceased to be evangelistic anymore. This was the tragedy of Madison. It really didn't. Wasn't evangelistic. And the units, when they got into that trend, they were not as evangelistic as they should be. And, well, uh, I left the Madison system. I decided I needed to have some practical training. I had learned a lot to do a lot of practical things, but I didn't have any real skills in any field. And in our institutions, we need people with good skills. And I decided at the age of 42, I resigned from presidency of an institution and went to Idaho to apprentice to the building trade. I left this institution. I went out there. I apprenticed to the building trade for 3 years. Then I went into contracting business for myself. I was out in the West 8 years, and during that time, I spent all that time. The Lord helped me to develop an evangelistic team, and the 8 years I was in the West, I had a self-supporting evangelistic team. The Lord helped us to bring many people into the church. Well, my time is gone. I'm going to stop right here. Friday night, we won't have a meeting in the morning. Friday night, I want to continue this. I want to tell you the story of Oak Haven and how I believe Oak Haven fits into this. But folks, let's remember, and I hope that I don't want to leave a wrong impression on people. God used Sutherland and McGann in a marvelous way. But folks, in their later years, something happened to them. Should that be a challenge to us? Something happened to them. I went to Dr. Sutherland one time when I was at Madison in school, and they were building their buildings. They were building, enlarging their sanitarium, enlarging their hospital. And I just read a statement in Volume 8 that says, the prophet sent a message to Battle Creek and says, when you have one-tenth the patients you have at Battle Creek, you have all you can handle. I went to Dr. Sutherland when I had that statement. I said, Doctor, you were at Battle Creek when that testimony came out, weren't you? And he said, yes. I said, how many patients did they have then? He said, 800. I said, then 80 is the limit, isn't it? That we can really operate under. At that time, Madison had 150 patients, and they were going for 200. I said, what are we going to do about this? Well, he just shrugged his shoulders and walked away. Folks, listen, we are going to have to realize, I don't care how great our work has been. Now, I believe God can save Sutherland and McGann. I believe they were good men. But Solomon had a problem too, didn't he? Did the Lord love him? And did he do a wonderful work? But he led Israel into apostasy. And I believe that Sutherland and McGann, I believe they're going to be in the kingdom. But I believe they set in motion a train of circumstances that will affect lives for eternity. And this is why I tell you this, not to say anything against these men, but folks, is there a danger that we can do the same thing? Can we serve the Lord all our life and turn aside? And thank the Lord, if we've served the devil all our lives, we can still turn and carry the right way. So folks, let's recognize that it's not enough to serve the Lord a while, but those are going to be saved that endure to what? To the end.
All right. Who'd like to pray this morning? All right, Brother John and Brother Flint.